how it started was a passionate golfer was out there. His name was Philip Young, and this was in the 1930s. And he was on the green, and he had a 8-foot putt, and he missed the putt. Got his dentist friend to actually x-ray that golf ball. And they found that the core of the golf ball was completely off-center. So he got one of his friends to create a machine that did the wrapping of the rubber. And he got a liquid core, and he froze it to make it perfectly round. And they made the first golf ball.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another podcast show. Let me just start by saying that it's been so overwhelming, Arthur, the response that we've had on this. I think we've had such incredible people on the podcast, and this morning or this afternoon is certainly no difference for us. We're very privileged to have Jesse Henny with us. He's head of development for marketing for Acushnet in South Africa.
Thank you very much. Really nice to be here. And thank you for the invite.
What a pleasure. I said to you earlier before we started that when this podcast launches, which is this week, and the first 12 episodes come out, there will be two of them under the Acushnet name. And it might look like we're punting you guys quite a bit, but there's relationships between us. And very importantly to us, the position that your brand carries in local golf and global golf. And I also think that not a lot of people understand that Acushnet is Titleist, FootJoy, Scotty Cameron putters,
and Vokey.
And Vokey wedges. And I think Scotty Cameron is something that people don't actually know. I asked around a little bit. Everybody got it right up until the Vokey wedges. Mm. But then on the Scotty Cameron, nobody really knew that it was incorporated into the Acushnet. So maybe, if you don't mind, and not putting you on the spot here, but maybe we can just start a little bit from your perspective on Acushnet. Because when we had Rudy in here, we didn't really dive too much into the history. And we obviously spoke more about tour fitting, where now we've got the brand here, the guy that's so passionate about it. I also, just on a side note before we start, Jesse, why I was so excited about you joining is that you didn't come from a traditional golf industry before you became the head for Acushnet. So it's quite an interesting story. So a marketing manager today that's in golf, if you want to know about how to do marketing, maybe today is the time for you to listen a little bit. I know that you're coming into a legacy brand, obviously, but what I felt was, and we went and dived into a little bit and asked into the industry, you've made an incredible impact since you've been at Acushnet. And you would have thought that was not necessarily the case because you would have thought that the brand, you know, already carried its position, but you made an impact on it. So welcome to the show. Thank you for the honor to be with us and for giving us your time.
No, absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. So, I mean, there was a couple of questions there. So I'll try.
It will become organized just now.
Yes. So I'll speak to the first one first, which is something I'm very passionate about, is the history of the brand. So I think if you look at all great brands, whether it's, you know, watch brands like a Rolex or a car brand like a Rolls Royce or BMW or Mercedes.
You just mentioned two of your biggest passions.
Yes, absolutely. So you look at any of those phenomenal brands and you look at any brand that you're obsessed about or have a passion for, they have this amazing, rich history. And Acushnet is no different and Titleist is no different. And we didn't set out to be a golf company. Titleist didn't set out to be a we didn't say one day, we're going to make golf balls and we're going to try and make money from making golf balls. Or we're going to make clubs and we're going to try and make money from clubs. How it started was a passionate golfer was out there, his name was Philip Young, was out there with his dentist friend playing a round of golf like we all do. And this was in the 1930s. And he was on the green and he had a 8-foot putt and he missed the putt. And he looked at his friend and he said, like we've all done before, he says, that was the equipment. That must have been because I hit a perfect stroke and that ball missed the hole. That did not roll straight. So most of us would have been, okay, fine, we'll just let that go. But he was so obsessed and such a keen golfer that he got his dentist friend to actually x-ray that golf ball. And they found that the core of the golf ball was completely off-center. And he measured 10, 15, 20 dozen golf balls. And every single ball, the core was completely different. So he was in the rubber industry. He was making swimming caps, and he was making different types of rubber products through the wall, etc. And he said, okay, I'm going to try and make a golf ball with a centered core. So he got one of his friends to create a machine that did the wrapping of the rubber, and they created a liquid.
Almost like Rackies back in the day.
Yeah, almost like Rackies. And he got a liquid core, and he froze it to make it perfectly round, and they made the first golf ball. Wasn't called Titleist, it was just a golf ball. And he got his dentist friend to x-ray it, and they found that they were able to get that core perfectly, if not, well, as far as possible, centered. A massive, massive improvement on everything. And they thought, wow, I think I'm onto something here. Because he was making those putts, and he thought he'd just staggered on something by chance. But it was based on his passion for golf. So that's an interesting story how Titleist got started. So he started making these golf balls, and another thing he did differently was if you made a golf ball in those days, you'd go to a store to sell it.
Hmm.
And he said he went completely different, and he said, okay, I'm not going to go to stores and sell this. I'm going to go to PGA professionals and tour professionals, and I'm going to try to get them to play the golf ball. I'm going to demonstrate why I think it's better. So he made a little machine, put it in the back of his van, and took it to golf courses and to professional events, and he showed them or demonstrated how our ball was significantly better than the other balls being played at the time. And it created, kind of snowballed from there. And he got what we call validation. So the best players in the world and PGA professionals were starting to play that golf ball, and they're starting to sell that golf ball. And that created some demand and interest from the broader golf market. But they were playing it because it was the best golf ball. Not because it was the best marketed golf ball or because it was the well-priced golf ball. They played it purely on performance.
I just want to interject there. You have to be very confident with your product to skip the retailer or the distribution and say, I'm going to go exactly to the guy that can judge the ball the best. Because even the retailers back then, I mean, what experience do you really have to know whether a ball is good or bad?
Yes.
Like you say, I mean, he was the first guy to scan a golf ball. So you sort of assume, this looks good. But he went directly to the professional and put himself right in the sticks of things by doing that.
Yeah, so he was so confident in the product that he had made that he went to that. And we still stand by that today.
Yeah, I was going to say. Know,
those guys with professional golfers and club professionals are making a living from playing golf. So they are more likely or inclined to play the best performing product. I'm not saying that money doesn't, you know, come into it. But in those days, you know, everybody was free agents. Nobody was sponsored. So they were playing the best possible ball for their game because it gave them the best performance. So from that standpoint, it was a huge validation. Because if the best people, the best players in the world are playing your product, they choose to play your product, that must mean that we have the best performing product.
Yeah.
And that's where it all started. That's our vision or that's our ethos for Titleist golf balls. And still to this day, we x-ray every single golf ball that ends up on the shelf or in the hands of any golfer.
I mean, because I know the story now, but then it started obviously with balls, and I don't think a lot of people would think that it started with balls. I think a lot of people would have thought it started with irons, perhaps, and then, you know, so it started with balls, but then there's an interesting story how you also got into clubs.
Yes, and that comes to the second part of your question, the Scotty Cameron question. So Scotty Cameron was a club maker before he ever had an association with Titleist. He was an OEM, so he'd make his own putters, and he had a passion for building clubs. Not just putters, but he had a passion for building clubs. But his passion boiled down to really putters, and that's where he could make the biggest impact. And he'd go to tours, and he'd get input from tour players about what their preferences were from the best putters in the world, and he'd base his designs on what those people wanted. And he had worked for the likes of Mizuno and I think Cleveland he had worked for at the time. So when it came time to in the 90s, I think it was around 94, 95, when it came time and he wanted to branch out and create a bigger kind of business, he reached out to Wally Ulan, who was the president and chairman of Acushnet at the time. And they had a bond. And there was a bidding war. to be blunt, there was a bidding war between the different brands, and he chose to move to Acushnet and make putters exclusively for Titleist. So the first was, I think it was called the Scotty Cameron Classic in 1994, and ever since, you know, his designs have been Scotty Cameron by Titleist, or at the moment the Scotty Cameron brand is so strong that I think that's why people don't think that it's a Titleist brand, because it's not under the Titleist banner. Mm. It's not a Titleist putter by Scotty Cameron. It's a Scotty Cameron putter.
But I think
for Titleist,
as a branding, a lover for brands and what it stands for. And I don't mean brands when we speak here, Jess, that it's necessarily in a, you know, aspirational in the sense of a Range Rover. And hear me out, or aesthetically something around you that gives you false precedence or false ego. I hope I'm positioning that in the right way, because a brand also can also. So let's say, as an example, if I buy a particular handbag for 50,000 pounds or rand, whatever it might be, there's a handbag that has just the same good enough quality for that exact same thing. It just doesn't have the brand connected to it. Therefore, it's half the price.
Yes.
Now, it's interesting to me that Titleist has made everybody stood on their own feet. If you look at FootJoy and Scotty Cameron, why isn't, so I know you just said that, but why is it not just slap Titleist on over it? So is it because Titleist felt that they've built up the speciality in the putting world, they've built up a name in the putting world, and let that rather be an independent arm focusing on putting, and we'll incorporate it into our brand? So let's say like a big group buying the company, or is it something that gets fully incorporated into the Acushnet brand globally? And it sits 100% inside of Acushnet offices and everything under their control, or is it still an independent arm? And why the different brands?
So, I mean, let's talk about Scotty Cameron. So Scotty Cameron is independent to a certain extent.
Okay.
He has, and I'll come back to it, but he has autonomy in terms of his designs and the materials he uses and the kind of direction he wants to take the brand in.
Okay.
But because it's part of the greater Acushnet company and part of the Titleist brand, sure, we will have say based on what the consumer market is saying.
Okay.
So I think that's the perfect marriage of how it should work, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So he's based in California, and Titleist and Acushnet are based in Boston, Massachusetts. So they are separate in a way. And going back to, you know, Scotty Cameron, you know, there is an allure for Scotty Cameron. People do see it as a aspirational brand. And it's not just because it's a Scotty Cameron and because it's a little bit more expensive than most other putters. That has to start from somewhere. And that started with quality. Quality and performance. And an obsession for those. And that's what separates Scotty Cameron to other brands and to other equipment manufacturers or putter brands, in that his designs are inextricably, they don't cut costs. He looks for the best materials, looks at the best designs, the most beautiful designs, the sleekest designs, and you know, he at all points is looking at quality above everything. So that's why, number one, you pay a little bit more for a Scotty Cameron, but number two, why the vast majority, or not vast majority, but a majority of golfers on the professional circuits choose a Scotty Cameron putter, because it looks good, it feels really good, and you know, it has the best raw materials on offer, and it's not made to a price. So if you're looking at quality and performance above everything else, that's why Scotty Cameron is where it is. And going to back to FootJoy is slightly different in that FootJoy has been around for a long time. FootJoy has been around since 1857. So it is one of the oldest, not just shoe companies, but certainly the oldest golf shoe company in the world. And it was primarily based on a classic style shoe. And we were the first people, FootJoy as a brand, we're the first people to kit out the Ryder Cup team back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And what separates FootJoy from maybe other brands is we are only a golf company. So FootJoy doesn't make running shoes
and
doesn't
hockey
make running boots, soccer boots.
Yeah.
We only make golf shoes. So our obsession is golf. So everything in our designs and our manufacturing capacity and the styles that we make is only for golfers. So it's a complete dedication to golfers.
Because it's admirable. You've got, you know, these big brands under one roof, and each one of them is the best at what they do in each category in which they serve. Which is something that I, when I first was introduced to you guys and got to know the story a little bit, I was quite amazed by. Because in business, I always say to people that, you know, we focus on big marketing launches. We worried about all sorts of 25 different details before launching a product or a service. And I say, if you make it to be the best service or best product in whichever category you serve in, as long as you can put a little bit of love and effort in the beginning, the market will respond, the market will then accept it, and the market will help you accelerate. But it doesn't help you have all these wonderful brands, all these professional golfers that promote your brand. You know, like we spoke to, when we spoke to Rudy, all you have to do is switch on the TV over a weekend and you won't get an ad from Titleist, but the professional standing there, the shoes that they're wearing, everybody around it, that is the brand. And everybody is with it. And also, I want to, and if you can just make sure that you can, all your marketing campaigns, you've got great customer service, but make sure that the product is still the best at what they do. But I see a lot of times at the moment, brands are being challenged. The big brands are being challenged on a car manufacturing scale. Balls, we see it at the moment. No, it certainly are. We see it in quite a few things. Then there's certain brands that are actually making quite an impact on things, you know, that you would have thought would never have been challenged. And I just want to quickly, and just as a relatability, Amazon is the largest movers of dog, pet food, or pet products in the world.
Yes.
But by far. 2 years ago, a guy decided to challenge them at what they do. And what he said was he's going to make the pet experience so personal because we care for our pets very differently than anything else. So all he did was same products, just 10 times better service, follow up. Today, he's taken 49% of Amazon in the first 2 years of operating. He's about to take them over entirely. So brands are being challenged in big podiums. How do we know for a fact, besides the fact that it's tour validated? Because in amateur's mind, we go sponsored versus chosen.
Yes.
Help us through that quickly.
Yeah. So, I mean, coming down to, I guess it comes down to a market share discussion.
Yeah.
When you're looking at being challenged, there are always going to be challenges in the space from other brands, whether that's brands that currently exist or new brands that are launching. There's always going to be that challenge, but from a Titleist and Footwear perspective, you know, we feel that we have to constantly innovate. If you are constantly innovating and constantly striving to have the best performing product across all the categories, that is going to be your best position, because that will negate any competitors that are coming to the market, because those guys need to make the best performing product. And I always use the analogy of what happened with Nokia and Apple. So if you go back 15 years ago, Nokia were number one.
Yeah.
In South Africa, at least.
Yeah.
Globally, also, their market share was massive.
Yeah.
But they failed to innovate. Whereas the likes of Samsung and Apple saw the smartphone opportunity and invested in that smartphone opportunity. And today, tell me, where's Nokia?
Yeah.
In the smartphone category? They're nowhere.
Yeah.
So they've gone from a company that had 50, 60% market share to they don't exist anymore.
No.
And we've seen that in the golf industry. If you look at what was played in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, many of those brands don't exist anymore. You,
Adams, remember?
Yes. Here's a stat for you.
Adams. Sorry, Jesse. What was it? Adams golf clubs.
Adams is gone.
I've got a five-wood year somewhere of him.
So the most majors won by a golf brand in history. Do you know what that stat is? Take a guess. It's not an easy question. Do you know this, Jesse?
I don't.
It's Wilson.
Wilson. It doesn't surprise me.
It doesn't.
Okay,
no.
But obviously because of their history.
Yeah.
But Wilson, and please, I might be wrong. It's either the British Open or most major winners.
One of those two.
Doesn't surprise me.
I hear you.
Yeah.
On that, and it's Arthur, so I suppose what we're saying is that, you know, and again, Jesse, we know you work for a very big company. We know who Titleist is. So you've got an aura. We understand when we see a Titleist bag, there's immediately a perception about it.
Mm.
The guy's got some loot. He's investing into good quality. When a guy's got a FootJoy shoe on, immediately it gets noticed. Mm. We know that. We're not here to sell the brand on anybody's behalf. Mm. So I think most golfers would resonate with everything we've said. They're the best. Everybody wants to be with them. Everybody knows it. I said the other day, who else has got memes about their balls hitting water or getting lost? It's only the Pro-V. It's the only ball in the world that got memes about not losing the ball or like funny memes that your mate sent you about the Pro-V. Or
yes.
Before a water hole, they take the Pro-V back into the bag and something in, yeah. else comes out. Your ball, your brand is literally that. And it's so far ingrained in us that it becomes part of your funny story in golf.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
So there's nothing we can say here today to change that. That you've done that, the brand has done all of that. But now we just talk to us as average golfers here. You know, and what was so interesting to me is one, I found out that what pros hit on tour with slight adjustments depending on the club or setting, we play and see what they play on tour, we play with, and we can go and buy in the stores. Mm. Also, the ball, like you said to me earlier, it goes through one more check, the Pro-V ball that the pros play with versus the Pro-V for the amateurs, and that's purely because it's professionals.
Yes.
And you said to me that the paint on the ball needs to be perfect because it's on TV all the time.
Yes.
That's the only difference.
Yes.
I never even knew that. And I think amateurs will find that very interesting.
Yeah.
It goes to the quality of your brand.
Yes. So, I mean, it boils down to, again, where I started when I spoke about that validation process and how that's ingrained in our DNA. We started off by going to the tour professionals and club professionals. It was only 3 years later. So we designed a golf ball, took it to the market for professional golfers and club professionals. Only 3 years later did that ball ever see the light of a shop. So that's ingrained in our DNA. And that's still the case today, in that every single product that we manufacture, goes to the tour first before it ever hits the shelves. And I think we're probably the only brand that can say that. So the ball, for example, whether it's a Pro-V1 or Pro-V1X, the ball that you're playing, that you can go into your professional shop, whether that's a golfer's club, a pro shop, a TrueFit Golf, or an on-course destination, whatever the case is, and you buy a dozen Pro-V1s, it is the same ball, the exact same ball that you are seeing the touring players around the world using. The only difference is that it goes through one additional quality check, and that is the paint, because like I said, you know, it's the ball is on TV.
But it tells you so about the love of your sparkling. Brand. I mean, it makes sense. It doesn't.
And it's not just the ball. It's not just it's the hardware as well.
Yeah.
It's the metals. It's the irons. It's the wedges and the putter, obviously.
Yes.
Which is important. Not a lot of people know that there are other brands out there that are playing with tour head only heads, and you cannot get it off the shelf.
So we in the industry we call it CPD products. Mm.
What's that?
So the CPD product is basically a made-for product.
Okay.
So let's say that you're a professional golfer and you want to join Titleist, for example. Or let's just say Brand A.
Okay.
You wanted to join Brand A. Okay. And you are changing golf balls, right? And you say, I want a ball that spins this much, that has this launch characteristic, that feels soft to me. I will design that golf ball. Brand A will design that golf ball for you based on what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur, another professional golfer, might come and be sponsored by Brand A and say, okay, well, I want a completely different set of characteristics. We will make a golf ball specifically for you. So that's easy to do when you're only making 20, 30, 40, 50 dozen golf balls, right, for specific players. Titleist don't do that. We have got one or two CPD products that one or two guys have used in the past, but it's a small handful. The vast majority, 99.5% of them, are using the ball that's available in the shop. And as Arthur rightly says, it's the same thing when it comes to golf clubs, same thing that comes with putters, wedges. The only difference is on the tour, they might be a little bit more custom made for you.
Yeah.
Aesthetically, it might have clarify.
Like we said, weight.
Let me clarify that. So if you buy a TSR driver, which you've recently launched, you might have seen TSR on, on the tours.
Yeah.
So it uses a aerospace titanium face. That is the same face that is found on tour. Uses a titanium crown, same crown used on tour. It has a SureFit hosel where you can independently change loft and lie, same on tour. The shafts, same on tour. Might get a little bit stiffer, tipped shafts, but you can still, through our custom process and get through TrueFit Golf, you can still get those shafts. So it's not like it's completely off limits. The only variance, especially in metals, the only variance would be is sometimes look, feel, and spin characteristics.
And sometimes look, I hear from a professional perspective.
What they can do, the tour fitters, what they can do is they can maybe put the rat glue, for example. All drivers have got rat glue. Whether you're a consumer, a normal golfer, or whether you're a tour player, they all have rat glue to get it to a certain weight. But what the tour are able to do is manipulate where that rat glue goes.
A weight perimeter in there.
From a weight, they can change it. Correct. You would probably know the ins and outs of that, but that's what you're able to do. And that does alter the sound slightly and the feel, because I believe feel equates to sound and sound equates to feel. But it might impact some of the spin characteristics. All the brands do that, but our brand specifically, Titleist, the product that you get when you go into the shop is exactly the same product that you buy, that you can get onto it. And that's across the board.
Let me just elaborate on this rat glue, or hot melt is the other word for it. So let's say, for example, you've got a Justin Thomas and he has a spin issue, for example, based on angle of attack or whatnot.
Yeah.
Then what they would do, they would inject the hot melt or rat glue into the head and obviously slant the head in a direction where the rat glue would move into. So let's say they would move it to the front of the head to lower the spin rate.
Yeah.
It's also going to make the sound compression a little bit softer.
Mm.
Okay, or if he needed more spin, they would move it right to the back. Or, you know, he might want it a bit more draw bias and he doesn't want to change it on the hosel, then they would move it a bit more lower down to the bottom of the face. So that's really, really cool from a tour perspective, but there's nothing else has changed.
Mm. But and that's a last resort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's be honest. Yeah. I mean, how often, you know, the tour players, you know, a handful of them are doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the vast majority of them are just getting standard job. Yeah. You know, they're getting fitted into the standard one. They might change swing weight based on their preferences.
I was just going to say, they also do it for swing weight purposes.
But that makes sense because, you know, we might be swinging at 100, 105 miles an hour. The average swing speed of
100%.
Is 90 to 95 miles an hour.
Any golfer that's ever picked up a club for more than one round understands their consistency in their strike. So you can almost manipulate the club to a 98% percentile to know that they will basically hit it off that face, where we have to have a little bit more give on amateurs because our response and our contact points are all over the place all the time. So you create a club that, you know, on the left side gives you a little bit more forgiveness and on the right side. But it is – so that's a big differentiator already. And I don't want to say it as a differentiator necessarily for Kushnet, but we always talk about it's slightly more expensive in the stores. Mm. There's a differentiator.
Yes.
And when you dive into these brands, there's always reasons why their positions are slightly different to others.
Yes. If anything, sorry if I can
interject. No, not at all.
If I go into Vokey, for example.
Yeah.
So Vokey is the other way of the – sorry.
No worries, sorry.
Vokey is the other side of the coin where – you are getting the exact same product that has been played on tour, and it's designed that way. So Bob Vokey, who started working for us in the 1980s, was actually a metals designer for Adams. And Founders Club. He is designing metals, and then he came to work for Titleist, and he was on our metals division. And one day in a meeting, and I'll go into this a little bit more depth, one day in the meeting, they said, okay, so who wants to we need some wedges, guys, because we were a golf ball company. We started as a golf ball company. It's always going to be, or always was, our flagship product. And clubs was an added value to the player who wanted a Titleist club to match his golf ball. But one day they said, well, who's going to make wedges? And Bob put up his hand and said, I'll make them. And he went out onto tour and he asked the best players in the world, what do you like about this wedge? What are you trying to get out of it? What kind of shot do you want to hit? How do you want the ball to spin? How do you want it to fly? How important is gapping to you? What kind of finish do you like? And he designed a product based on that feedback. And that's where those grinds and lofts and finishes all come from the tour. And we brought those in, designed them, manufactured them for the best players in the world, and then started selling them. So when you buy a Vokey SM9 5610S, what do you think that S stands for?
Anybody know what the S stands for? I must be honest.
I'm hoping I'm going to get it right.
Arthur, I hope you're going to get it.
Standard.
No. So it stands for Stricker.
What?
Yes. So
Strick?
I used to think that when I was a kid, and I then for some reason changed over time.
Just so I missed the word?
S. So Stricker.
Hang on. So the bounce, you get, let's call it 56,
yeah,
10 bounce.
Yeah. S. Completely understand.
S. And you would get an M grind, and an F grind, and a K grind, and an L grind.
Yes.
So now, what is L for? Because L's for technically low bounce.
No.
It's zero, like.
Okay. So yes, but basically his work with the tour players led to those designs or those grinds. So the L grind is based on his work with Phil Mickelson. So Phil Mickelson's nickname is Lefty.
Lefty.
Okay.
So the L grind comes from Lefty.
My goodness.
So that design is a low bounce, a lot of heel and toe relief for people who like to manipulate the club, open it, close it, flop it, whatever.
So what does F stand for? Furyk?
No, so F is the only one that actually isn't designed based on a person's name. That actually means full soul.
And K?
It's a Tom Kite.
Okay. And M?
Because K is
You get the M grind.
Is the high bar.
M grind, don't you get the M?
Yeah, there's an M grind. Again, there's a, I don't know if I can share it on this podcast, but it's not named after a player. Bob Vokey says M stands for... most favorite grind.
Okay.
Because he feels that that's the grind that can offer the ability
to
people.
I thought it was like a mid bounce.
But
here we go.
The inside story, and I don't know if we're going to edit this in post, but.
we can.
Inside story, the M stands for a grind.
Okay, we'll
that's
post. Yeah, we'll so keep that.
Keep it.
No, just mark it on there.
With a beep.
So the reason why it's because it's a difficult grind to achieve.
Okay.
So to actually grind it. So if you take it down to the natural elements of it, you know, somebody's standing there and grinding it based on what the kind of shot the guy wants to do and kind of the interaction he has with the turf and his angle of attack. So that's what comes down to that validation and why that validation is so important. Because we're not going to the market saying, here are a few grinds, do you like it? We're going to the best players in the world and saying,
and then pushing
you guys
back.
Can play every shot under the sun. Give us feedback. Tell us what makes the best wedge. And we making it. And then selling it to weekend golfers and dedicated golfers and serious golfers around the world. And they know that they can count on our performance because it has been proven to work among the best players in the world who are making a living from doing this.
And also, sorry, Albus.
Sorry, Arthur, not at all.
Vokey has got the most grinds and bounces out of any wedge. Correct
Absolutely.
Me if I'm wrong.
Yes.
The amount of grinds and wedges they have is actually overwhelming for a fitter because there's so many options.
Yeah.
You know, other brands, you've basically got a standard bounce and a high and a low bounce, and that's it. You know, Vokey is really on point when it comes to their bounce options.
Yes.
Arthur, I think that the average, and I want to say, I bet you 95% of people right now with any wedge in their bag, it came purely from feel. So you take it out.
Or what they've been given based on what they've been sold to.
100%.
Know, or just because it's in stock.
Yeah.
Because
one thing we've broken down on the show already is that it's not an expense, an additional expense to go and get fitted. There's purpose in it. It's not reserved for your wealthy people. You can get
you're actually
going to
save money over time.
Correct.
Absolutely. If you're not getting fitted.
100%. We also started speaking about train for purpose. Don't just go into the range and hack it away for 45 minutes. That if that's not relatable to you, you're absolutely doing nothing for your game.
No.
By going in there and creating bad habits and the whole thing goes on a weekend, I go, but I had such a good range session. I was smacking them 300 meters out of the air and now they can't even lift it 120 meters out of the air. So we talked about that transition. Then we're now talking about like being a bit more informed when you go and purchase these clubs. So education, you know, and it's difficult. And I understand, and I relate to retailers as well. You know, it's people on the floor. You maybe get a good day with them. You maybe get a bad day with them. But I can tell you guys now, we don't go very informed into the retail stores. What we get told, I mean, here I am in the golf industry, Arthur. I should know a lot more and I don't. You know, I still get fooled by whatever industry tactics are used to put us into these clubs. And again, I'm not saying from a bad place or negative place, but I think it's about time that golfers become a little bit more educated onto what they have in their bags and for what reason. Because my last Vokey, which was the 60 degree, which I had to replace, I replaced it there at Bryanston the other day. I'm in the golf.
Albert, thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks, Arthie. I'm in. Yeah, but here's the point that I'm going to make. I'm in the golf industry. I didn't see it necessary to go and get fitted for. Yeah. You hear what I'm saying?
It's impulse buy.
It's an impulse. And what I did was I literally bought the last SM9 because the grind to me is slightly lower at the top. So it feels like it hits the ball bigger contact versus the SM9, which I had was a bit thicker for me. So I felt like...
Did you have a previous SM9?
Yeah, previous SM9. Now I feel like, so that's what I bought it on. So I go outside, literally just a little bit outside onto the, before the green, and I just can feel it a little bit, and I'm like, I'm done. Pick it up, pay for it, and move on. And I just go back to time. Golf is a time-consuming thing. We spend a lot of time and money on it. It brings us so much joy. It plays such a big role in South Africa. It's such a fantastic sport. Just take a little bit more time into what you purchase and what and how you train yourself. And here for the first time, we're not asking you to listen to American and British voices, which, like we've said on the show many times, it's brilliant, but they talk from a different world. You know, that driving range sees 100,000 people a week, you know. That fitter, you know, gets 400 people through their stores a day. It's a different world out there. 30 million golfers, 157, whatever you want to call it here in South Africa. So this platform is exactly what we try and do, Jesse, is so that you can come on as a club to not give you a punt up or not to promote you, but to say, here's the story. Here's your story. And if you look at things like what the pros are playing versus what we're playing, well, that's starting to say, well, we not just say we're the best.
Yeah, it is.
You look at the shoes. There's no doubt about this. I don't care what you say. Anybody that's ever put a pair of FootJoys on their feet, and now that we found out from Rudy the other day, in fitted shoes. It's important to fit your shoes. But everybody knows, if I give my mate, and I did the other day, I gave a mate of mine a pair of FootJoys that I had in my cupboard. I had it for about 6 months. When I'm on the course, that guy goes, how's the FootJoys?
Well, it's the number one shoe in golf.
How's the FootJoys? He's not going, how's the golf shoes? Yeah. Or, you know what I mean? He's, how's the FootJoys? Huh? But even from a branding specialist perspective, I was like, does anybody know how much it costs to build a brand? Mm. It is costly.
And how long it takes.
Now you've got four brands.
Yes.
You do.
Yep.
Firstly, Acushnet's not known. Let's be honest. Who knows who Acushnet is?
Yeah. Unless you actually
in the industry. Unless you're dealing in the industry, nobody knows who Acushnet is.
Mm. Yeah.
Everybody would say Titleist. That's the major one. And I bet you now, if you bring people in here, they won't know FootJoy and Scotty Cameron and Vokey.
The only way you could maybe put it together is if you watch a lot of TV, golf on TV, I mean. Because then you're basically looking at him from head to toe and then looking at his bag and you can see he's playing
and the cap.
And the cap.
The cap is a big
So you can see he's playing a FootJoy shoe and he's playing with a Scotty Cameron putter, etc. But if you're not paying attention to that, it's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so it should be. Those brands are standalone brands.
Yeah.
They have their own identities.
Yeah.
They have their own histories.
And that's what makes it work like that.
We always, even internally, we have a FootJoy team, we have a Titleist team.
Yeah.
You know, and yes, we do, we collaborate and we share a vision for the company. But realistically, Titleist is on its own journey and FootJoy is on its own journey. And from a marketing standpoint, like I am, you know, I've got to steer both of those brands on their own journeys.
Yeah.
And that's really what it boils down to. FootJoy, you know, has been around since 1857.
Mm.
You know, we only purchased the company in the 1950s. Acushnet purchased in the 1950s. Yeah. So it's got a rich history that we need to not only celebrate that heritage and history, but the biggest key for FootJoy and what's made FootJoy so popular, at least in the last 5 to 10 years, is we are reaching a whole new audience by breaking down barriers for the footwear brand.
Yeah.
In that, yes, you can get a classic traditional golf shoe that footwear has become very well known for. But there's a whole myriad of other shoes that we manufacture, from a casual golf shoe to an athletic golf shoe to a contemporary golf shoe to a classic golf shoe. And even the classic golf shoe is a take on the old and the new.
Yeah.
So it's an old style. If you look at the Premier Series, for example.
I see it
looks like the old FootJoy Classics. Mm. It's a leather upper, but you feel that in weight even compared to the old Classics.
Rudy wears them daily.
It's so much lighter.
Mm.
It's so much lighter that you won't even feel it on your feet.
Yes, back in the day, if you played with the Classics and played 36 hole, my man, you're going to know about it. Back in the day.
Yeah, 100%.
And now Premier, we know that. So we started using soft leather.
But even even the lower cost shoes that's come onto the market is definitely more comfortable than what they used to be.
Mm.
But it is still costly to get to that ultimate comfort between quality and comfort, because it's not cheap to do. If it was, then everybody would have the same shoe. You know, everybody would make a great shoe for cheap, that's comfortable, ticks all the boxes aesthetically, because aesthetics also plays a role in the shoes that we that we pick up. And you know, Jess, that's why, and what's so nice is that for the first time, and I personally believe for the first time, except on a one-to-one conversation, all of us in South Africa that's looks at the brand for what they are. Always, you know, anybody that really want to have a first choice is that's the brand that you want to play with. Mm. Yeah, you've got a South African voice right now sitting here explaining to us the differences between your brand. Mm. And that's perhaps why. And of course, I understand retail. There's also markups in retail. Everybody's got to make their margin. But positioned in the products and in the store, you're positioned as a more expensive product.
100%.
But if you actually look into it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But
if you look into it now, obviously I deal with different products.
Yes.
Retail products. And it's actually not more expensive than other brands right now. Actually, the TSR is cheaper than two other brands, okay, from a retail perspective. So, yes, it's a premium product, but it's also affordable to where it needs to be. They're not overdoing it because it's Titleist and they've got tour validation and all that. Mm. It's actually, they're not screwing the consumer to just say, listen, we are the best. My price is my price and that's it.
Mm. Yeah.
They're actually very, very reasonable, as well as their wedges, as well as their irons.
Yes.
It's not like there's a 3 to 5 or 10 grand difference because it's Titleist. Not at all.
Titleist will never be entry level.
No.
We will always be premium, and that stems from the fact that we are striving to make the best performing products in the game.
Yeah.
And to create the best performing products in the game, you need to invest.
Yeah.
And by invest, I mean you need to invest from an R&D standpoint.
Yeah.
You need to invest from a human standpoint. A lot of people don't know this because they've seen Titleist predominantly in the last 30, 40 years as a golf ball brand. And the clubs, you know, people thought of Titleist clubs as being for only for serious golfers.
I was just going to say, I'm so sorry to even interject there, but that is exactly one of my questions that I was going to ask, because before Titleist was considered a low handicap club, and I'm not talking about an amateur. Forget the professional terminologies and all of that. I'm talking about an everyday golfer.
Yes,
you didn't look at Titleist if you were a 18 handicap or 15 handicap or 20. It's amazing when you speak about innovation, how much Titleist has done to change that perspective. Mm-hmm. And now it's it's got one of the largest ranges.
You've got all options.
Options, you know, on the market. But it certainly stemmed from a place. I mean, back in the day, my father always used to, his Callaway was the, for you know, that would be for the higher handicap player.
The game improvement clubs.
In fact, that was the exact words that was used.
And going back to pricing, the game improvement pricing is different to a players or premium forged club. Because a game improvement is cast, okay, which is cheaper metal to a forged. So you've always got to vary the two and look, okay, what is in the cast category price-wise, what is in the forged category price-wise, and then you can actually look at it together, if that makes sense.
Yeah, completely, 100%.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's of our own doing, to a large extent. So even before I joined the golf industry, before I was with Titleist, when I was playing golf as a youngster, you know, people would say, well, why don't you play Titleist? Wow, I'm not good enough to play Titans. Yeah, exactly. And that was a perception that and we I could created. Never afford our kind of, what would you call it? Our slogan was serious clubs for serious golfers.
Mm. Yeah.
So automatically.
I'm glad you mentioned it because I quoted as well.
That's saying that it's serious golfers. But in the last, and I guess, you know, we're well known for our MBs and our CBs and maybe our AP2s at the time, which were very much players' irons. That was exacerbated, and I say exacerbated in a good way, by our strength on tour. So you put that serious clubs for serious golfers, plus the number one played club on tour, you're going to get that perception.
Yeah.
So I think we cause some confusion in the markets. So in the last 5 to 10 years, from my standpoint and from a company standpoint, it's been trying to change that. So our ethos at Titleist Clubs now is for dedicated golfers.
Okay.
So there's quite a differentiator between serious golfers and dedicated golfers.
Mm.
A serious golfer might mean somebody who plays it for 1, 2, 3 handicap, plus one plus handicap, or a professional golfer, or even aspiring professional golfer. A dedicated golfer, you could be a 20 plus handicap, or you could be a scratch handicap. Mm. What that means is you're dedicated to the game. You are a member of a golf club. All right. You are practicing your golf a lot. You're investing in your game. You're going for lessons.
Mm.
That's what a dedicated golfer is, a guy who wants to get better.
Mm.
And a guy who wants to get better is willing to invest in his game. So whether that's invest his time or his energy or his money. And that's the differentiator. So if I'm a 20 plus handicapper or 15 handicapper, but I'm playing regularly, you know, and I want to buy a set of irons, we've got a set of irons for you. We've got the T300 or T400 irons that are made specifically for that type of golfer. If you want to be, if you're a 5 or 6 handicapper who hits the ball a long way, who wants to shape the ball, puts a lot of preference on feel, we've got T200 or T100 or T100S for that type of golfer who is getting that technology that's going to help him to do that. If you're a professional golfer who is hitting the middle of the club 99% of the time,
as big as your pinky.
Yes, yeah. And like you mine. you put feel and the ability to shape the ball above everything else. We've got a CB and we've got an MB on offer for you. And that's a golden thread through our whole product line. Whether that's drivers, we've got the TSR4, which is for the guy who really wants a low spin, club speed, who doesn't struggle to get the ball up in the air, who might want to just reduce his spin a little bit. But then you've got the TSR2, which is, you know, it's got a very forgiving face. And it's for the golfer who doesn't traditionally hit the middle all that regularly.
So the sweet spot's bigger.
Yeah.
The sweet spot is smaller in the TS4 because the CG is very far forward to drop the spin rate.
Okay.
The minute the CG goes far back in the club, forgiveness goes up, just for the listeners to understand. And
Arthur, if I go to your fitment this afternoon, I do that as an amateur because I will always speak when I speak, you know, you'll always speak from a professional capacity, but I go to and I find those two clubs and I'm let's say an 11 handicapper. Well, I feel that.
If I had to give you the TS4 with the right shaft for you, hypothetically, you will battle to find the sweet spot if you're hitting it all over the face, and you will feel this just feels cuck.
Okay,
you know, it just doesn't feel sweet.
Okay,
can't find the sweet spot. Ball's going to dip and fall out of the sky. It's just not going to feel great.
It's the law of averages,
correct?
Really, because there might be an okay, and this is the problem I see a lot of golfers making. They'll go in for a fitting. It doesn't matter the brand. They'll go in for a driver fitting, right? And they'll hit 15 shots, okay? And they'll find a driver that one of those shots goes 25 meters further.
Yeah, and because, that's the one.
Because it's a super low spinning driver.
Yeah.
Okay, but that one shot that he hits out the middle is going to give him the best launch and spin characteristics, and he's going to hit it further. Doesn't matter about the other 19 shots you've hit. So that's what that product's giving you. If you want to hit that one shot longer than your mates by 20 meters, yeah, maybe go for that.
Mm.
But what we're looking for is probably the best overall performance.
Yeah.
Something that's going to give you really good distance consistently, really good tight dispersion,
yeah,
consistently.
Yeah.
It's going to look really good to you while you're over the ball, but that's also going to feel good because that's going to give you confidence to swing harder. And realistically, I mean, there's a lot of marketing around there about club head speeds and swing speeds and ball speeds. Realistically, we've reached the max of what can be achieved on off-center strikes. I mean, yeah, on-center strikes.
Yes.
So at the middle, we are governed in terms of how far what the CT can go.
Mm.
Where we can make big improvements is on looks, feel, and off-center strikes.
And yeah, shaft quality.
And maybe shaft quality, sure. Yeah. Because the way I see it is the head is the engine.
Correct.
And the shaft is the gearbox.
Okay.
Okay, that makes sense.
To get the best out of your club, you know, the
DSG gearbox goes far better with an engine than the power in the automatic engine.
Can be great, but unless you can put that down onto the road,
I hear you.
You're not going to. So the shaft and the head combination, and that's why, if you're going to spend R10,000 on a driver, or R22,000 on a set of irons, even if you're going to spend R14,000 on a set of irons, get fitted.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Gone are the days when you can walk into a shop and just get something off the shelf. You can do that because a lot of the brands are putting really good shafts or good shaft offerings.
The shaft has improved tremendously.
Yeah, and not just the shaft. In those days, you could get that club with that shaft.
I had no options when I was a kid.
Now you can get that club with 5 different shafts. Mm. That'll fit the majority of golfers.
But Jesse and Arthur, don't you think that it's almost... So a buyer, I feel, when we go to the shops, okay, so let's think about any retail shops, whether it's for golf clubs, shoes, clothing, we are dictated by the buyer. The buyer's going to decide what he's going to buy, what he puts on the shelf. So he's going to say, I like this color. I like my consumers really like this look and feel or whatever it might be. We are not necessarily the choice makers in what goes to shelf. So when you get to the pro shop, or any retail store for that matter, when you get to the retail store and you've got all these options, then you get to one brand, it's got 4 or 5 options in it. If you're not going to have somebody that's going to guide you through that process, there's no way you're making the first choice off the shelf just right. That's just not going to happen.
It's like test driving a car. If you buy a car without test driving it, you're so stupid.
Yeah.
Well, why do that with a golf club?
Yeah.
Because it's also expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so...
And then changing that, Jesse, so from your perspective, so again, speak to the average amateur. If Rudy was sitting here, I completely understand from a professional perspective, their hit rates, that's why the ball lasts them far shorter than an amateur. But how often should I look at all of this?
So I number one, let's look at it from a total tightless standpoint first. Number one, golfers aren't stupid anymore. You know, there's so much literature. You just go onto websites, there's forums, there's content platforms where you can read reviews.
Yeah.
In the past, you couldn't have that.
Yeah.
So people are a lot more educated on what they want. That does create some confusion, but number one, get fitted. If you're serious about investing in your game and you want to play golf regularly, have fun, and improve your game, go get fitted, okay? And whether you get fitted for something that's R10,000 or R30,000, you know, that you can work out later in terms of what fits your budget. But go get fitted.
Yeah.
Because that's going to help you play your best game and help you to enjoy the game. So for the average golfer, I say, if you're going to start the game, go get fitted. That's number one, right? Number two, get fitted for a golf ball. Because nobody ever thinks about the golf ball.
Yeah.
What is the most important piece of equipment in your bag?
The
only piece of equipment that you use on every single shot. Is the golf ball.
Never
it doesn't matter what golf ball
way.
You play. I don't, you know, obviously we want you to play a Titleist golf ball and primarily our best Titleist golf ball, which is a Pro V1 or Pro V1X or some preference for an AVX or left dash. Mm. But consistency is the key because you want to know that if you hit a good shot, it's going to perform how you expect it to perform because every ball's got different launch characteristics, spin characteristics, and feel characteristics. Excuse me. So what you want to make sure is if you're hitting a shot, it's coming out the same every single time. But what do we as golfers do? A lot of golfers, one round, They'll play a certain ball.
Yeah.
From hole to hole, they'll play a different ball.
Absolutely.
Some of them will use a second-hand ball.
By the big balls.
Go by mixed bag or whatever.
You were saying it earlier. Smart. You know, you get to a par three. You don't want to lose your Pro V1, so you take out another ball. You're probably going to lose that ball because it's not going to fly as far. And it's not going to spin as what you used
and
to.
You're like, damn it, why didn't it go onto the green? Yeah. Well, you just took a ball that's going to give you 20 meters less.
So whatever ball you play, play it consistently.
Yeah.
Get fitted for that golf ball because, you know what, if spins your demon and you're spinning too much with your driver or your irons or your wedges, go for a low spin ball because that's going to knock more spin off than you could possibly do by changing the shaft.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying possibly. Yeah. It's all player dependent. You know, if you hit the ball too high, you know, you can change the head to go a lower lofted head, or you can change the shaft to go with a lower launching shaft, or change the golf ball. Go with a lower launching golf ball.
I mean, you could have a head shaft combination. Let's say you're going into a low launch shaft. You know, the forgiveness is not as good as a mid to high launch shaft. Now, you like the feel of a mid or higher launching shaft, then change your golf ball.
Because
you're getting the feedback that you actually enjoy.
I get what you're saying. I get what I'm saying. Yeah.
So there are options. I didn't think about it that
way. I mean, how often do you go and you're about to play a round of golf and you go half an hour beforehand or 45 minutes beforehand and you want to hit a few chip shots? And you go there and you're playing the range ball. It's probably been through the ringer. It's got no spin left. Right, and you're practicing all the time with that ball. I promise you, if you put a Pro V1 or Pro V1X or any one of our balls in play, it's going to check a lot quicker.
Quicker, yeah.
So what you're practicing with and the shot that you're used to hitting is going to react very differently when you actually play a round of golf. It's the same thing with wedges. I tell people with wedges, whenever they get fitted for wedges, the difference between a new wedge, right, and a wedge that's perhaps 2 or 3 years old that's played more than 75 rounds of golf. Sometimes the difference is up to 1,000 RPMs of spin.
Holy moly.
So, you know, grooves, they deteriorate over time because you're consistently hitting the golf ball. You know, you're playing out of the bunkers.
It's not off a perfect tee.
No.
And you're also hitting
It's in rescue shots. It's in stones. It's against the wood.
You're sandblasting it.
If you're playing out of the bunkers. Fair enough. I've never thought about a sandblasting. Yeah. But that's exactly what we're doing.
So, I mean, that's our wedge. We've done the research to show that, you know, the difference between a brand new wedge and a wedge that's had 75 rounds of play is up to 1,000 RPMs. And that might not sound like a lot, but if you look at what that really means, that means sometimes the difference between a 25-foot putt and a 10-foot putt.
Yeah.
On the golf course, that means a lot.
Yeah.
That sometimes means there's a difference between, okay, my number is normally 90 meters with a sand wedge.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden it's only going 80 meters and it's going higher than it used to.
And it's going to affect, if I'm right, from an amateur perspective, of where you shape the ball to, whether you spin it back, where you land it, whether you roll it out. All of that will come in. A lot of amateurs, that's how we play. We play, we say, let's say, to the tee or to the middle of the range or to the flag, let's say 80 meters, we would say, okay, my type of shot bounces and rolls forward, so I'm going to hit it 70. Where if you understood the ball dynamics and you understood between the club dynamics and the ball dynamics, you can actually say, well, I'm going to throw it slightly over and then pull it back.
Mm.
You know that some people will actually go cheap on the golf ball and then manipulate their game suited to that golf ball because of pricing, where you could pay a bit more premium and actually start throwing darts, hypothetically,
and
get more feedback and performance, which is sad.
Yeah.
But so Arthur and Jess, to both of you, so if I go, so we understand, and like we always said, there's a price point as well. So let's say I'm now buying a 50 Rand ball versus a 60 Rand ball, and you know which one is 60 Rand.
It's even getting now to 80 Rand.
80 Rand, oh my God, it shows you. I should start looking at the prices again. The difference between those balls. So I'm an amateur now today. I'm a 212 handicaps hitting off at the same time, hitting identical shots in a perfect world, same chip shots, all of that. Theoretically, will the Pro V or the Titleist brand last me longer than the other ball, or is that not really how you position a ball to be better than another?
So, very, very good question. So I can't speak for the other brands, but I'll speak for Titleist as the number one golf ball brand in the world. We understand that there are preferences. If you took money out of the equation and you're just looking for the best performing product, everybody that's the most durable, that's going to work for you on every single shot, you'd go with Pro V1, Pro V1 X, AVX, or Left Dash. Depending on your swing, your type of swing, and what you're looking for from a golf ball. But we understand that not everybody's going to buy a Pro V1 or Pro V1 X. And there are going to be preferences. There are preferences for price. There are preferences for color. There are preferences for feel. And there are preferences for spin. And that's why we have other golf balls in our range. Or else we'd just have those balls. And what we try to do is make the best possible ball for that category. So if you look at, you got premium performance, which is Pro V1, Pro V1 X, AVX, and Left Dash. Below that, you've got a performance range of balls, which includes Tour Speed, Tour Soft, Velocity, and DT True Feel, all made for different types of golfers who are wanting, who have different preferences. Mm-hmm. So if you want an orange ball, right, we can't give you a Pro V1 in an orange ball, right, but we can give you a Velocity in an orange ball. Right. If you only want to pay, if you say, okay, well, I love the game, I really love the game, but I have a budget and I want a budget for 20 rand a ball or 25 rand a golf ball, and I love soft feel balls.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a ball for that. It's called the DT True Feel. So, and we feel that in every single category, we are the number one in that category.
But Jess, would you agree that there's maybe some work to still be done on the balance of the balls for Titleist? So I'll give it to you just as an amateur, as an example. We would consider Pro V1 as your first choice, okay? If you can't afford that, you would buy the perceived best one in a different brand. You won't necessarily think to go a cheaper Titleist ball because it
Yeah, so I get what you're saying.
You get what I'm saying?
So it's almost like... Let's use this as a comparative.
It's either premium or nothing.
So that's if you're buying a Porsche. That's how it feels. Yeah.
If you're buying a Porsche,
but yes. I also
you want a 911 turbo. Correct.
Yeah. You know? And it feels like
even though they make a Carrera and they
100%.
However,
because there's even something called the poor man's Porsche. You know, and that's one of those the entry level Porsche where it's like, well, if that's the only Porsche you can afford, then why even buy a Porsche?
Correct.
Yeah. Just go buy the top of the range Audi.
It doesn't matter if those Porsches might be the best in their category. At that price point.
That's certainly a perception. But also, I will say this. I also think the retailers position it that way. Because it's not like you'll get the Pro V and a range of balls next to it from Titleist. Mm. You will get the Pro Vs on a separate corner, and you'll get the best of each other brand in the same shelf space or whatever you want to call it. It's not like Titleist sits there. Pro V is the ultimate. But if you want a bit of a softer feel, well, this is the ball for you to choose from. And I know... so much and so in deeply that it's so difficult at retail to communicate that unless you have people and humans that does that interaction for you. That's also a cost and an expense. Plus, in the retail stores, you can't say to them, be dedicated Titleist salespeople. They have to sell across the brands that they carry.
Yes.
You know, at different price points.
So that's a marketing kind of responsibility in not only educating consumers and golfers about our products, but also educating the trade, educating the salespeople to be able to best, give advice to golfers. And unfortunately, in the South African market, there are quite a few misconceptions, about our brands and about, let's say, golf balls, for example. So golf ball, if you look at, I mean, we've been in the industry for a long time, but golf balls have generally been fitted on swing speed.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, you swing it at 110 miles an hour, you can play a Pro V1.
Okay.
But if you swing it at 80 miles an hour, you can't compress it enough.
Which is actually bull.
Which is an absolute misconception. You should never... The golf ball does not know who's hitting it, right? And if you look at it, a high-speed camera, which we've done, the difference between how much the ball's compressed at 110, 120, 130 miles per hour and how much it's compressed at 190 miles an hour, there's no difference. And we can back it up because you know it's the number one ball on the ladies tour, Pro V1 X. Why is it the number one?
Because swing speed.
It's considered our hardest golf ball.
Yeah, it's not because of swing speed. That's just validating the swing speed.
Yeah.
mentality of the golf ball. Saying if you have a high swing speed, Pro V1X is for you.
Yeah.
Okay. But now the ladies who swing it
90 miles an hour.
Oh. 90 miles an hour, some 80 miles an hour are still using the Pro V1. Now you've got two different club swing speeds with the same ball and the same results, and there's no difference. Okay, so going back into the golf ball, I think where the guys aren't doing justice that are selling the golf ball do not have the education or the knowledge of the lower range golf ball in Titleist, for example.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you want a cheaper ball, for example, I'm going to name the brand, the guy's going to go for a Schicks and Softfield because that's what they know over the years and what they've been taught to sell, for example. So I think it's an educational point of view. So going back to the educational part, when I did my master fitting and master club building in America, came here to open up TrueFit, had a meeting with Jesse and said, I want to sell your product. He said, you're not going to sell my product until you do Titleist University.
Yeah.
Which obviously shows they are really good at making sure that the product that's getting into the consumer's hands is correct, or the people that are doing it have the knowledge to give the right product to the consumer, which is Titleist in a nutshell.
Yeah.
You get me?
Yeah.
So I think, I don't know if it's worldwide or locally, I think we need to probably educate the people who are selling the golf balls to just do a bit of homework, look into it, and there are other options. And I'm not saying just Titleist.
Yeah.
It's other brands as well. There's always a ball suited for a particular individual, and I think that's crucial.
Yeah. 100%. 100%. And I mean, we at Titleist, we have the saying, which is an internal saying, that an educated golfer would almost always be a Titleist golfer. Mm. And that's more so on the ball side, the golf ball side. Just primarily because we've been making golf balls for so long. And it's one thing, I was telling you earlier, it's one thing making one golf ball. A lot of people can make a good golf ball, a box of it, or two boxes, or three boxes. It's another thing making a million golf balls. Because then, not only is it a good ball, it has to be consistently a good ball. And then you've got to have that investment in R&D. You've got to have the experience. I mean, the staff making Titleist golf balls at four of our ball plants around the world, they have a combined, each person has got on average 20 years of experience making golf balls. You can't buy that.
Yeah.
And another important thing is we are the only golf brand, in golf balls at least, that own our entire process. And what I mean by that, I'll clarify that, in that we make the tooling for the golf ball to make the golf balls. We make the raw materials. We own the process. We own the quality control. We, from start to finish, we are controlling that whole process.
Yeah.
So everything from cradle to grave is ours.
Yeah.
At no point, if something goes wrong with that golf ball, we can say, it's our fault. We're not outsourcing anything. We're not outsourcing our cores. We're not buying in urethane from a manufacturing company that comes in a pellet and then you have to melt it down.
Yeah.
We get a liquid form urethane. We're the only people who do that. A liquid form urethane for Pro V1. And it is cast thermoset, which means
You're a manufacturing company. You're a manufacturing company, yes, which involves engineers, doctors, professors, innovation,
scientists, aerodynamicists.
And I just want to on why that is so important. Christian and I spoke about it earlier as well. So Elon Musk, it was an interview once, and somebody said, "Oh, but did you see this new car that they launched out?" And he was like, "Oh, the new concept car." Says, anybody can impress me with a concept car. That's not what makes me different from everybody else. I can give me $100 million and I'll give you a concept car for that will do anything you wanted. It's in the production consistency. Mm-hmm. That's what separates me from the rest.
Yep.
I can make this car, the same car, every day, and I can make 13,000 of them a day, as an example. That's not exact stats. Mm. But that, and it made so much sense to me, where he's like, listen, anybody with 100 million rand in America, that's quite easy to talk about money like that. I can give you money, build me a car, but then can you commercialize that car? Can you put it into a factory environment and make it cost effective to reach the consumers?
We are making, Titleist are making 1 million golf balls a day.
Yes.
1 million golf balls a day. So if you want to create that loyalty and that trust in the brand and the product that is going to work time after time after time, you need consistency. You need to own your process. And that's why touring players, that's why they play our brand, play our golf ball, because they know that they can rely on it when, let's say this weekend, Max Homer. So Max Homer under massive pressure, one of our ambassadors, he had to get up and down to stand a chance.
Chip it in.
Mm.
Right? He needed to rely on the fact that that wedge was going to interact with the turf in the way he's become accustomed to it. It was going to hit the ground how he's become accustomed to it, and it was going to react how he wanted it to react under pressure. Under pressure in the moment of truth. And that's what people rely upon with Titleist. And they can only do that because we are the most consistent ball. In 2001, when Pro V1 launched, it was by far the best golf ball.
Mm.
There wasn't even a comparison. People were automatically getting 30 yards of distance. You went from let's say 40% of the field playing a Titleist ball, to literally 90% playing a Titleist golf ball. It's changed. A lot of the other brands have certainly made improvements and that gap is no longer what it used to be. But what separates us is certainly the consistency.
But allow me to lead into something there where you said about the tour players taking that ball up, which was such an organic way because they found it to be the best. They rely on the best because their sponsorship, their standing in golf, everything around them relies on them performing on the course. Because they can be great personalities, they could be the, wonderful people, but if they don't perform on the sport, the sport leaves you behind.
Sure.
If I have to now take your top 100 ambassadors today around the world, because it feels like if you open up the Sunshine Tour app, it's Titleist, almost spot the non-Titleist guy. But if I have to take all of them at the moment, and I know you might not be able to give me an exact answer, and I say to them, all sponsorships are off the table. Here are 4 OEMs for you. 4 balls, 4 clubs, 4 drivers, 4 wedge sets.
Mm.
Out of those 100 players, how many do you think will pick up your clubs?
Our clubs?
Clubs?
Well, it's all a combination deal with Titleist.
I know it's a combination. So I'm saying take the sponsorship out.
This is a great question and a great line of questioning because I want to clarify some misconceptions that are in the industry. This thing of sponsorship. So how do you define sponsorship? I mean, sponsorship is I give you a dozen golf balls. You play a dozen golf balls. Every tour player can do that, whether it's our brand or any other brand. They can pick up the phone and say, I'd like to play your ball.
Okay.
Most of the time, the company will give them a dozen balls, right? Then there's sponsorship in that I will pay you $20 million to play my product.
Yeah.
Right? And whether that means playing just the golf ball or having a 14-club deal, or a 12-club deal, or whatever, however you want to skin that, right? Titleist only have 2 sponsored players in the world, in that we only pay them a sponsorship fee.
This is an interesting stat.
So this is very different. No one knows about. Again, it's very different in that we don't sponsor any players from a cash perspective.
Injection, yeah.
We don't say, I'm going to give you $20 million to play our product. We only have 2 players like that. The rest are what you call a performance sponsorship agreement. Performance incentive. In that we will sponsor you the golf ball or the clubs to play with because we want you to play our golf ball and our clubs. But if you win or if you finish in the top 10 or if you finish in the top 20 or you make a cut, we will pay you based on your performance.
Yeah, I hear you.
So that's very different to how a lot of the other brands might do it. So we don't have any sponsored players from that perspective. So
blow my mind, Jesse. I thought you sponsored every one of them.
No. So there's not one, there's not one player on the Sunshine Tour. I could be mistaken and we're probably going to need to get the
right guy. I don't think there's one.
But that means that they can get those clubs from any OEM.
Yes.
They can. I mean, any one of them can phone that guy and say, can I try out your clubs?
Yes. But
if I may interject here.
Yeah.
If you're looking at any tour around the world, which tour, is more likely to play the best performing product because it makes a big difference performance-wise, and their livelihood. The Sunshine Tour.
120%.
You can be in the top 50 on the PGA Tour and you're making millions.
Millions. Even top 130, yeah. In fact,
on the Sunshine Tour. On the Sunshine Tour, you know, you've got to be consistently basically performing to make money. And surely it's improved. The money on the Sunshine Tour is much better than what it used to be. There's more opportunities for those players to make a more living, tournaments, more tournaments, more sponsorship, etc. So they're doing a great job from that standpoint. But if we took away performance agreements, I don't think our ball count would drop at all.
Mm-mm, also,
even if it means the difference between two or three shots over a round, over four rounds, because that's in essence what it is. Little changes, people win by two shots.
So basically, in a nutshell, Titleist is saying, yes, it sounds bad because I sell all golf clubs, but this is honestly the fact. Titleist is saying that our product is the best. Okay? If you want to make a living with our product, here's the tools to do it.
Yeah.
I'm not paying you $20 million.
Yeah.
This is lacquer. Yeah. Now you must go. You've made your money now. So it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Their product is known to perform. And if you want to play with the best product,
yep,
there's your option. It's not here's money, just play with my product and go and, you know, we're done and we see our product on TV. It's not like that. Mm. Other brands do that. The minute you tee off with a driver, for example, you get paid from another manufacturer.
Mm.
And not a lot of people know that in the public, which is crucial because it's fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not to say, don't be naive in that, you know, when you see Justin Thomas playing our equipment, we're paying him money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but we're paying because he's performing using our product.
But we've also seen Justin Thomas for Justin Thomas now. We're not looking at him when he was nowhere on the circuit.
Yeah.
As an example, now he's in, you know, red lights to all of us, and we know exactly who he is.
Also a great
kind of validity story again is what we call next generation. Next generation meaning elite amateurs.
Yeah.
Elite amateurs who are, you know, they're really good golfers aspiring to be on the Sunshine Tour, European Tour, PGA Tour. You know, those guys generally are not getting sponsored. A handful of them maybe are because they've been earmarked for the future. But generally speaking, they can play what they like. They have to pay for it, most of them.
It wasn't really legal to sponsor amateur golf. No, it's still not.
So they have to beat their rival next to them, teeing off next to them.
Yeah.
So they want to make sure they're playing the best performing product. We are by far, doesn't matter if you look at it from a South African standpoint, European standpoint, or a collegiate standpoint in America, we have got 80% plus ball counts.
In Asia.
You know,
Across the board. As well. Because there's, I mean, we don't have to mention them, but there's obviously massive brands connected to Asia.
Mm.
I didn't know on the Asian tour it's also so big, your count.
We are number one on every major worldwide tour in the world.
If that's
good question, Jesse. Where does Pro-V come from?
Pro-V?
Yeah.
The name Pro-V?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's again one of these interesting stories about the brand, what makes a brand so exciting, why it connects with people. So Pro-V, one, there was a gentleman by the name of Bill Morgan who designed, manufactured with his team the Pro-V 1. So, ultimately, this is a cool story. So, in the 70s, now imagine this today, in the 70s, you know, you could play a different golf ball on every single hole.
Oh, my word.
So let's say you pegged it up on the second hole and the wind was pumping.
With a Kirkland.
And you said, okay, I want to hit this ball low. You could pick out a low-launching golf ball and hit that ball for that hole. The next hole, the wind dies down. You say, I want to hit the ball high. You can take out a completely different golf ball and play it. So much so that the USGA and obviously the golf officials who make the rules decided that, okay, we're going to put an end to that. You have to use the same ball
across
the round.
Yeah.
Right? So that got us thinking and said, okay, well, that means we have to make a ball that performs everywhere. So if you want a low spinning ball or a high spinning ball or a ball that goes, because in golf ball technology, it's very difficult because there's two halves of it. You can create a ball that's got a lot of spin, and you can create a ball that goes a long way. Creating a combination of that is a very difficult thing to do. And that's what Pro-V1 ended up being. It became a ball that went a long way, but also offered a golfer a lot of spin around the greens. So he didn't have to make any sacrifices.
Yeah.
So when they launched that ball, you know, we had to rush. We got the ball. We put on a tour, and we had to send the patterns to the USGA. And in order to do that, you have to give them a name. So, you know, Bill Morgan said, well, what name? I'm gonna, okay, so he wrote down Pro V1 because he stood for pro, standard for professional. We already had a professional ball. It was being used on tour. V?
Version 1.
No, V for veneer. So veneer was the thing that we struggled with the most with Pro V1 is getting the veneer right.
The outer shell. Though.
The outer shell, the urethane cover.
Yeah.
Because that gives the spin.
Yeah.
Really, that gives the spin and the feel. And the paint, obviously. Veneer and one. It was the first submission to the USGA. So that's where Pro V1 comes from. Professional veneer one.
My word. Most of the best products in the world have a funny story like that. Yeah. Because when they developed the product or submitted it, they didn't really think of the success it's going to reach.
Or the name.
You know, or the name. Just and like now it sounds so normal to us. Pro V1, it sounds like, what a good name. You should just probably like put a team on that, development team with a design team and a word team. So it was just actually Pro V1.
Just like the word Titleist. So we in South Africa say Titleist.
Yeah.
But if you hear the Americans say it on TV or inside, it's Titleist.
Yeah.
And the reason is the Titleist is means the person who wins the title.
Okay. The winner. Okay. Titleist. Yeah.
The winner of a tournament is the Titleist. So we created the word Titleist. And what happened with the script, our logo, was that we said, okay, well, we've got this cool name, Titleist. It stands for everything we're about. What are we going to do for a logo? So the secretary at the time just wrote down Titleist and submitted it. And they were discussing logos and designs and everything. And they looked at the script that the lady had written in her cursive. They said, wow, that looks really nice. Let's just go with that. That looks amazing. So that Titleist that you're seeing on his hat or what we call the symbol of excellence or the script, that is somebody's handwriting that became a logo, that became a brand. That became, you know,
synonymous
with golf.
Everything good in golf.
Yes.
Okay, so Jess, we won't keep you for much longer, but general golf industry, you weren't born into it.
Sure.
You sort of found your way, you know, through experience and people into this industry.
Mm.
What do you think of it? And if I say, what do you think of it? It's, do you feel there's progress being made, that it's not just elite, you know, only for rich people that can play the sport? But do you guys mark, because obviously I know you're heavily involved in golf development, we won't go into all of that today, but Titleist is not just a product, a manufacturer and an OEM, they're also massively in golf development. They help a lot with a lot of developments in schools and foundations around the world to help golf and grow and etc. for the next generation. But what is your position in golf? Sort of, what is your feel around the golf industry and where it's going? Is it exciting? Do you feel it's still being still a little bit old school and snobbish in a way? And then just the last part, if you don't mind answering it for us in two there, and we'll finish on this part, is just marketing and golf industry. Because you've now got a product that's got decades and decades behind it. You know, it's bloody good. It's validated a vast majority on every single tour around the country. So I'm almost saying, what job do you have?
Yeah. People think I don't work. Just play golf for a living.
Valid question, Jess. Yeah.
He's never at the office. I don't know what he does. I'm joking.
So let me answer the first one. I think golf is in a really exciting place. I think as a nation, you know, we are sports nuts. And as a nation, we punch well above our weight from a golf perspective. Great, we only have 130,000 registered golfers in this country.
Yep.
And yet behind the US and UK, we've won more majors than any other nationality in the world. That's massive.
Yeah.
So,
and it's tens of millions. Tens of
millions. You got
it's not millions, it's tens of millions.
I think you've got 500 million people in the US playing golf. Yep, I mean, not playing golf, in the population.
Yeah.
And you've got in the region of 40, 50 million active golfers.
34, I believe.
Is that right?
Active registered golfers in the US.
Yeah, I might be wrong there. But, you know, we've we're in a position now where I think the industry stagnated.
Yeah. Mm.
There was this boom in the mid to early 2000s.
Yeah, but don't you think the last 2.5 years was yes. a
huge yeah.
So we had a plateau over the last 10 years.
In fact, I would say and going backwards.
Yeah. And COVID,
yeah.
you know, although it had terrible ramifications for everybody in different industries, you know, people personally,
yeah.
for golf it was really good because it showed that people could get out onto the golf course.
Yeah.
How healthy golf was.
Yeah.
How good it felt to be out in the open air.
Yeah.
How good it was to play sport again.
Yeah.
To be with your friends. How important being your friends, walking down the fairway with three of your closest friends or family was to people. Yeah. So from a golf perspective, it was really good.
Yeah.
And obviously, as a brand, as a company, you know, we benefited from that because people were buying more golf balls, more hats, more clubs. You know, they had the disposable income because, you know, they weren't spending as much money on fuel.
Yeah.
They weren't going on holiday. Mm. They weren't maybe spending money on cars and everything and going out to eat, etc.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they had money to spend. Yeah. And they were showing their money with the golf and with playing clubs and
but buying family clubs and family memberships also went up.
Yes,
It's not just on the golfing side, because I said to you know, if you have to ask my wife, would you rather go and sit at the club on a Sunday, you know, be there with the kid, great food, all the different amenities, or go to a Papa Chino's? She would choose every single time.
Yeah,
safety at the club far safer than, you know, as an example, in a commercial setting. Service and food in those clubs are absolutely incredible in golf in South Africa, especially. We are just spoiled. There's running, there's trail running. Yeah. So clubs have really paddle tennis, you know, massive squash and tennis and everything that attracts it to a club. Mm. And in the all, you know, there was a time where clubs were considered that snobbish sort of time. It was, no doubt about it. But I also see clubs have adjusted. You know, they've also, it's not a matter of you must look decent, and of course there's golf attire, but I don't need you to wear white socks. If you don't have white socks, we kick you out of the club, or whatever the case might be.
Yes.
So absolutely. I see clubs have also come to the party to help grow and stimulate the game.
Yes. And they've needed to. They've needed to. And it's good for the game. And, you know, they've made it more attractive. You know, unfortunately, there's the bodies have done all they can to grow it organically. It needed something unorganic, I guess. Completely. I don't know if that's the word. Like a COVID
intervention
to give it that injection. And now they've got the injection, and it's up to each club, each a body, each person involved in the golf industry to kind of make hay while the sun shines and grow the game.
Yeah,
it's all of our. Everybody who benefits from being in the golf industry, I believe, whether it's an equipment company or a golf course, it's our responsibility to grow the game. So from our standpoint, that's why we invest in the development of the game as best as we possibly can. But I think you see the memberships coming down a little bit. They're doing social memberships. The clubs, they're making rounds of play a little bit more affordable. And we forget that. You go and try to go play golf in America, or try to play golf in the UK on a half decent golf course. You're going to pay a lot of money.
A lot of money.
If you compare it to what we're able to provide here.
Yeah.
I was talking to my colleagues recently in Canada. They're able to play for 6 months of the year, because the other 6 months they're under snow.
Under snow.
We are so fortunate, we can play all year round.
Oh, yeah.
Even when it's silly cold in Joburg. Yeah, yeah. It's better than a day in Ontario. So, you know, we're very fortunate that we can play on these beautiful golf courses that are generally really good condition, and at an relatively affordable price. That's all, you know, relative.
Relative, of course.
But if you just pound for pound or dollar for dollar, it's certainly... Golf is in a well positioned and well primed to grow from here. And then to answer the second part, that's a long winded part.
No,
but the second part is from the marketing standpoint. I think the question was, how did I get into the industry?
No, actually, Jesse, you're making that much nicer than I asked it.
Okay.
I said you are with the best company. They've the vast majority control on every tour. Why do you have a job?
It's just like
that's not exactly how I position
it. It's just like any other job, you know. If you work for I don't know, Tiger Brands or BMW or Pick and Pay, you've still got a job to do. You've still got to sell products. You still got to market them. You know, just because we have what we believe is the best performing product, we've still got to tell people that story.
Yeah.
You know, we've still got to carry on innovating. We've still got to keep pushing the boundaries. And we still got to, there's a lot of misconceptions.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I have a job.
Yeah.
Or else we could just put Pro V1 there and people buy it all day, every day. And we still got to continually educate people why it's the best ball for your game, why our clubs are designed for all types of golfers, why shoe fitting is so important, why our apparel, for example, is so premium.
Yeah,
it's always a story to tell, and that's why I love the golf industry and why I have a job, because there's always those stories to tell. And it's better sitting in an office where you have a view of a golf course than a view of the city.
For sure. Jason, of course, you know, I was just tongue-in-cheek there. because what I respect about that, and if you go back to the origins and everything we spoke about today, Titus's mentality, Acushnet's mentality globally is to keep innovating. And even in marketing and the messages that we do, it's almost a humbleness and an appreciation to say, well, we are not so good now that we think we don't have to talk to our consumers anymore.
No.
We have to put those channels. In fact, we have to make sure it's more relevant than ever, bigger than ever.
Yeah.
And you are a MotoGP man. I know that you also have a passion for cars. If you look at Formula One, was in exactly the same boat before the last Netflix launch of the series.
Yes.
Formula One was not a dying sport, but there was less viewership.
Yeah.
No doubt every single year they were losing people.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it was always kept away from us in such a distance. All you saw is the Monaco and the beautiful stuff and the, you know, all the women that's beautiful around it. Everybody's got wealth and it's just incredible. But what the Netflix show did for you all of a sudden is it brought you to the to the people. You could understand the guy that's behind the car, developing the car, the guy in the pit that, you know, that's head of the pit stop, what he does and how they train, the regime that they have to train it. And I believe Netflix, Formula One should, the marketing department, whoever came up with that, they should thank them that they started that, because what an incredible accelerator for Formula One. And we feel exactly the same way. And that's why I'm telling you now, Jess, we are only at the beginning of really marketing or speaking, communicating about the brands we represent. Because they've grown up in times that we weren't even born.
Yes.
You know, so those stories are lost on us. So all we see today is perception. So it's good that we start these conversations with OEMs to sit down with us and say, listen, we are your consumers. We appreciate that you are involved with the top players in the world. But I'm the guy that creates the economy. 99% of the amateurs creates the economy for the professional to be able to be afforded that sponsorship.
Yes.
And that's what I really enjoy, is that one, just like in Formula One, you know, you can see your neighbor right next to you.
Yeah.
I appreciate it, the way how you spoke about other people in the industry or competitors or OEMs. Because one, all those people that are in those companies, they've got jobs and families and everybody to feed. So I appreciate how highly you spoke of everybody, that you didn't have to speak about this one is worse than us. You spoke about your brand value proposition, the benefits, the value, and what you, why you guys do what you do. That's what you came to explain to us here today. So we really do appreciate that openness. And thank you for such a big brand to be brave on a very unknown podcast, very unknown platform, you know, slight credibility on that side, a big, much more credibility than this side. Here we sit and you're allowed to come and talk to us. So it also shows me that you guys are also a human brand. So thank you very much for opening up today with us. And Arthur, thank you also very much for adding value here today for us. And I know that you work with Acushnet and with Titleist, and let me not keep saying Acushnet, but with Titleist and all the other brands that they have on a daily basis. But like you say, there's a brand and a place for everybody. What we want to do is to give our consumers the opportunity to understand what they are saying,
and to educate them.
And not in the educational way that we're sitting here as superiorities.
No.
It is literally saying, I am just as dumb as everybody else listening to this. You have a lot more insight, but here's the platform. Explain to us what's going on so we understand a lot more. And I can tell you right now that the next time, on this Saturday or this Sunday after you've listened to this, when you put that Titleist bag on your shoulder or on your cart, when you tee up that Pro V or when you take that Vokey wedge, it's a completely different story now.
Mm.
You now know a lot more about the brand between Rudy and Jess. You know what their values and philosophies is on a local basis. And for that, we are so grateful for giving us that opportunity, Jace.
No, absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Anytime that we can connect with golfers, you know, who are passionate about this game, or people in the industry who want to shed some light on this on the game, you know, whether it's, you know, I think this platform is much needed, a platform where people can engage with people who are similarly positioned, who are passionate about the game, who enjoy the game, who can talk openly and honest about the game, and just get enjoyment from talking about it or listening about it or sharing the same enthusiasm about it is great. So we appreciate the opportunity to talk about our brands and the opportunity given to us to get to know the Titleist and Footwear brands a little bit more.
On the next episode of The Human Golf Show.
Any person that just to live life successfully, you need to be mentally equipped. So the mind is with the self. What you think and say to yourself about yourself, that's very important.